Hello and welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. Our guest for this episode is Matt May, who is a developer, technologist, and accessibility advocate at Adobe. In this episode, we talked about all things accessibility, Adobe and the Creative Cloud, and of course, Internet Explorer 4 channels. Christopher Schmidt and I, Chris from Canada, are your co-hosts for this episode. Christopher is hosting the online CSS Summit late in July. Check out the details and tickets at csssummit.com. Also, be sure to pick up his latest book, Designing Web and Mobile Graphics, sold at dwmgbook.com and wherever fine and illicit books are sold. If you want to learn more about podcasts, check out my podcast series, Show Me Your Mic, at ssktn.com. And of course, Dave's usually here, but he's off saving the world from bad web design. His latest book is CSS, The Missing Manual. It's an awesome book, and check it out on amazon.com. Of course, all this stuff and show notes and everything else will be found at nonbreakingspace.tv. Our guest, Matt May, can be found on Twitter at Matt May. And also check out the Adobe Accessibility blog at blogs.adobe.com/accessibility. So thanks for listening to our show. We had a great time chatting up with Matt May. If you love it, please give us a rating on iTunes or leave a note there. We have very fragile egos to nourish over here. Enjoy the show.
Well, welcome to the show, Matt May.
And thank you.
We're honored that you're here. Well, the first question that we ask everyone is, how did you get into web design? How'd you get into it? Because one of the reasons why we ask that question, I love asking it, is because our industry is relatively young, and so people just didn't go to school. Most people didn't go to school. Say, hey, I can't wait to learn to code or make a web page. You know, and so like we kind of backed into a little bit, if you will, into web design. So I was just kind of interested how like this crop and this generation like got into web design.
So. Oh yeah. So I was actually thinking about this morning that, you know, I was in web design when the hipsters in San Francisco were into Jungle. So I feel like that's a generation ago now. So the first time I touched a web page was I was working on Windows 95 tech support in Colorado Springs.
Wow.
And there was a knowledge base that Microsoft gave us that we, you know, where we shared with, I was working at Digital of all places at the time. And, you know, there were a bunch of other companies that were, you know, IT provider or support provider people. And we couldn't contribute back to the Microsoft knowledge base. So we had these answers to questions, but they hadn't been vetted. And So the way that we started sharing that information was by creating an internal website for our own people. Oh. So I got to, you know, that was like before Internet Explorer 1.0, that was before Internet Information Server. So we had this like MWAC server that you know, old school Windows NT server, and we had a lot of free time and we had Microsoft Paint, so we got to do some kinds of, you know, hacky kinds of things. And the time came where I had to decide, like, do I want to keep doing tech support or do I want to do something else? And I jumped over to a web design company in Colorado Springs that had clients like the USA Weightlifting, USA Hockey, US Space Foundation, the Free Willy Keiko Foundation. And that was what got me into the design end of things. I had, you know, a bunch of clients that were really early into the web thing and I could kind of shape what they were doing.
So it was you created your like an intranet for your team. Is that what?
Yeah. Oh. So and it was until we got IIS 1, which was like right at the end of the time I was working there. I was 96. It was basically just, you know, we were sharing over Samba. we had shares with HTML files that were linking to one another, and we were just kind of learning that way.
What was Samba?
SMB, like the Windows file sharing system. Samba was the open source implementation of that that's in Linux and all that fun stuff. Or open source ish. Anyway, we just had like file shares that had HTML files in them, and that was sort of the level of sophistication that we had. But we, you know, it seems like a no-brainer to talk about links.
Right.
You know, it was just like they sprang fully formed and everybody just kind of understood them intuitively. And it wasn't really that way. You know, like we learned a lot about organize, you know, about organizing and navigating and, you know, adding new nodes into that structure. So, you know, I kind of got semantics down and information architecture at a rudimentary level down really before I even opened, you know, a graphical editing tool.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like back in the day, like we were just like, we're really concerned about the aesthetics of how an HTML document looked with just like text and links and like paragraphs and bullet like lists and stuff like that. So like when I first made my web page, it was just like, this is cool clip art from this other site. And it works when I load in the web page, because I hadn't figured out like, you know, image file types yet and which ones were available on the web page and stuff like that. So it's, but yeah, so I feel like that's definitely.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was impressive that we could do that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah,
we had this, you know, and the things that we learned, you know, and that ended up sort of shaping the next 5 years, the Dark Ages, the killer websites era, were that we could, you know, that we could use fonts and we could do these, you know, we could do these big images and send them over. And we, you know, we kind of had this embarrassment of riches in this, you know, in HTML, and, you know, CSS popped up a couple of years, you know, within that time frame. And, yeah. You know, we started to use Java and then JavaScript, you know, like Java was like, oh, wow, we could totally do all of this really cool stuff now.
Yeah. I could do a cool ripple effect when my mouse hovers over a photo.
Yeah.
That was pretty sweet.
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah. that's kind of funny. Cause like, that's like, I totally embraced the whole killer websites, whole thing about that. So, and, when that happened. So, but, it's funny that you reference it as Dark Ages. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, actually, it's kind of the, you know, because now I'm, you know, my specialty is accessibility or universal design, and I can sort of pinpoint a couple of points not far down the road from there where it became obvious that was going, I mean, that we were doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I worked for Expedia, and I don't know if you remember the IE4 channels.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Sort of. Yeah. I don't know.
So there was this, for those of you who don't remember that far back, the when Internet Explorer 4 came out, they were really touting this dynamic HTML thing. And in order to show it off, they did they had these bundles of it was basically like a zip file containing a manifest and a, you know, which was actually a precursor to RSS, the CDF format. So it contains the contents of the this thing, and then this HTML, CSS, JavaScript mashup thing that you could run solely on the client. So, I mean, it's kind of like the widget specification right now, except it was over 15 years ago. And I was pulled in to work on the Expedia channel for IE4, and they had this fair map, which they were like so excited because you can drag these flags all over the screen and you drop them, and then it would give you like the current low fare between those two cities. Mm-hmm. They had hired a design company to do this, and this page was like 64K of HTML to be able to drag all of this stuff around, which doesn't seem like, I mean, but we're just talking the HTML, not the images or any of the collateral files. Yeah. And so they handed it off to me, and I'm looking at all of this duplication and this crazy stuff, and I'm like, we need to tighten this up like a lot, because 64K was a lot when we were all using like, you know, 28.8 modems. So I got it down to 8. Mm-hmm. And the way that you do that is, it, you know, was by determining what is this information, how am I going to use it, and how can I minimize the bits over the wire doing that. Mm. So that was sort of the first, you know, my first optimization jag, where I was just trying to figure out how do we, now we have these tools, how do we do this stuff efficiently? How do we do this the way that it was intended? Mm. And then a couple of years later, I was working for an online grocer called Home Grocer, which was later bought by Webvan, And that's a whole different story.
Pour one out for WebVan.
Yeah, right. Actually, don't. Just let it. Just leave it. Leave it dead. That's all I want. I have this like WebVan decision tree, which was like, I worked there for about 10 months, which was enough to see sort of what it was like. They had they had engineers that were there, that were posting like Glengarry Glen Ross quotes on the board just to show like their dissatisfaction with the organization. But the WebVan decision tree was like, what's the worst possible thing you could do right now? Like, do that. Are you out of money yet? That was basically sort of every decision that they made. But anyway, the original like online features that came out in like the late 90s, their pitch was, here are all these soccer moms, economy's on great guns. They have all this disposable income, and delivering groceries to them would be a profitable enterprise. And you'd be surprised how close we actually got to showing that that could happen. Like, we had some centers that were actually starting to turn a profit, but it was just, I mean, the day that Home Grocer IPO'd in 2000 was the last day that the NASDAQ went up. When it hit 5101, that was the day that we IPO'd. And it went down 70% from there. So we never got to actually prove that this was a viable thing. But while we're getting all of these like soccer moms calling in, for help or to give feedback or something like that, we had some other people that were like, hey, it's really nice that you're helping all these people out, but let me explain what grocery shopping is like for me. I'm blind, so I can't drive to the store. So I have to get somebody else to drive me. And either they help me shop, like walking me through the aisles, or I have to call in advance and I have to pay a delivery fee and I have to listen to the list of items and then tell them what I want and they pick it for me. And then I, take an access bus or get a ride and do that. So
were these people just asking you, or did they call you up, or did you go out of your way to find them, or
they were actually, calling our customer support lines and saying like, it would be really nice if awesome. You could help me. And, people were kind of wringing their hands over that, because it was like, do we create a whole different site for them, or what do we need to do? And so I kind of jumped on that and, started to think about what can we do in this pretty, high volume. I mean, there are like 30,000 items and you're supposed to pick like 30 of them in 12 minutes. So it's not like it's not like an Amazon where you pick like one or two things out of 2.5 million. So it's like you make the search box accessible, you make the lists accessible, you make the checkout accessible, and you're done. Mm. There was a lot of human factor stuff to go around in that. But the idea that you could use this technology for that kind of good was a pretty powerful thing to me, and it's stuck with me throughout my career.
So is that when you became more focused on accessibility, or was that just another, just one of the touchstones that led you to?
That was like the moment really for me. Once I got into that kind of work, it was, I had joined a W3C working group, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines working group in 2000. No, 99. Anyway, like 3 years later, I was working for W3C, running a couple other accessibility working groups. And so that was, it was having the perspective of somebody that's in business who has had to make the case that this stuff matters to people who are just like, look, we're going to go under in 3 months if we don't do XYZ. So prove to me that you can do this stuff and we can try to make money at the same time.
And for folks who are listening, who maybe accessibility is a word that they have certain connotations with, I guess, and what does it mean to you, and what does that sort of the passion or the interest that you have for that translate to? Because you've talked about, the getting the file size down for bandwidth for folks with, back in the day, really slow connections, but even the day today, like mobile, et cetera, versus also just people with visual or auditory disabilities and accessible issues that way. So where do your passions lie, and what are sort of the things you cover when you're looking at accessibility?
Well, the things that I talk about most often right now are more about universal design, that that if we talk about accessibility as a subcategory that's only related to people with disabilities and their physical obstacles to accessing the content, we're creating a kind of false dilemma that we have to solve this or we can do really cool stuff. And that's a really common misconception, and it's one that really gets in our way. And also issues of social stigma associated with disability, really, I hear a lot of things that, you wouldn't say about any other minority group said about, customers or users with disabilities. So when I talk about universal design, on the other hand, it's more about, it doesn't matter whether you can see or how well you can see or hear. All of us are going to have the same kinds of problems if we open up a page on our iPhone in direct sunlight. Uh-huh. If the contrast is low, if you have low vision, that's going to be a problem. But also if you're outdoors, that's a problem too. All of us are going to have the same kinds of limitations, and that's including the ability to read long passages of text, the ability to just sort of keep your attention on a given thing at a given time, to respond within a set number of seconds. All of these things even our bandwidth and our connectivity are factors in there. Like you're at a Starbucks with a flaky Wi-Fi connection, and you're trying to get tickets off of Ticketmaster, and they say, "Oh, you got 1 minute to do this next thing," and you're like, "Okay, now it just cut out and I can't do it, and so now I don't get to see Daft Punk," right? So all of these factors are things that we need to think about. And I feel like the things that we've done in the research of accessibility and web accessibility in particular are good usability guidelines across the board. When we express them as good usability guidelines across the board, then we can start saying, like, if there's anything that's specific to someone with a disability at that time, we can explain that to them and people understand it. But if we go into an engagement, or if we go up to to ask for accessibility as such, it's such an easy thing for people to just marginalize, and it's kind of it's discriminatory. It's facially discriminatory. You can't really make a case that you just go, I don't really care about those people right. as a class, and that's not discrimination. But there is a way that we can work together to solve these kinds of problems if we all just get behind the fact that we're all human. Some of us are actually going to lose our vision. Some of us are, a lot of us, on a long enough timeline, all of us are going to be disabled. So the issues that we're encountering are the ones that we are going to be facing ourselves at some point in the future.
Yeah, I think that's like a powerful argument to make, is that we're not building things for, if you need to like break through to someone, like, if you don't use the argument, like, we're not building the sites for a group of people, we're not building it for more of an audience to come, like the web van, where we actually make our sites more accessible, get more customers. We're actually going to build it for ourselves, and that, we're actually going to like lose our vision, down the road, and, or we might, lose a leg or something like that. Like, just, we need to make sure that, or lose an arm or something like that, make sure that we actually use the stuff that we build for ourselves. And, I guess I had a Twilight Zone episode where the guy loses his glasses and can't read any books.
Right.
Sorry, guys.
We have this, we have this saying, like, we're designing for our future selves.
Yeah.
An example of what's come up sort of recently. Amazon, their Kindle books have only really recently sort of had an improvement in their accessibility on like iOS. The Kindle Fire is based on Android, so as I understand it, they're working on that too. But could you imagine, you've been buying these Kindle books for 5 years now? Mm-hmm. You've collected maybe dozens or hundreds of these things. And you go out and there's an industrial accident, you go blind and your library is gone forever. Mm-hmm. those kinds of things, like if you put yourself in that situation, mm-hmm. and realize that like we're not all blind from birth, we're not all deaf from birth, we're not born with a lot of the disabilities that we acquire, this is something that these things evolve over time, and when we look at it from that perspective, we start to realize that, okay, when I'm 60 years old and I'm looking at retirement, do I not want to be able to use my retirement website, efficiently? And of course, 30 years from now, I mean, as far as we know, the web might be injected into our brains, but but realistically, we're going to come to expect that whatever size screen, or if it's whispered into our ears, or some smart agent pulls this information down and reads it to us, we are going to demand. That's going to be like a human right that we be able to do things like voting, like banking, like shopping, mm-hmm. reading. That's not going to be negotiable. That's not just going to be like, oh, well, those people over there, they're only like 1%, so we're not going to worry about it. It's going to be everybody that is going to expect that kind of equal access.
Right. Yeah.
It's not that we have to think about accessibility on the side, but we have to think about it integrally as a thing that we have to understand and respond to just as part of creating this kind of content for people. It's always about the people. It's not about like whether we can use Node.js and things like that. People get kind of wound up about the technology behind the stuff. Mm-hmm. But then they kind of forget that there's this really inconvenient, wet, fleshy thing at the other end of it that we're actually designing for. So I feel like I just, I'm just that voice in the wilderness sometimes where I'm like, hey, remember that there are people that use the web, That's really sort of what being an accessibility advocate is about, that we can't systematize everything about it, because the people at the end are always going to be different.
Well, like, how do you feel about, this is something I've just been thinking about. I feel like we're in like this growing pains of the web and the internet, and that, we went through the whole .com bust era where people didn't think that, I don't know what they thought, like ease of mailing someone digitally is a stupid idea, or buying stuff through Amazon was a stupid idea, and that therefore, digital companies are as a whole were a dumb idea, and therefore, we shouldn't, whatever. That's a sore subject for me. But anyway, so we went through this whole idea, and I feel like, companies now, especially like credit card companies now or financial institutions, when I deal with them, they're like, we really want you to go paperless. And I was like, well, if they're going to be on the cutting edge of like saying like, we really just want to interact with you on a digital level in order to keep our, the cost of having you as a customer very low and our profit margins higher. That's going to just trickle down to government eventually, pretty much, if not, already with online utility paying bills and also paying bills, but also, having websites and doing all sorts of that.
We're already seeing that hugely at Adobe. So that's so, one of the first things that a lot of people have to ask. So
yeah, I feel like with the whole NSA thing or whatever, I just feel like everything's gonna be moving to a digital thing, and yet we have this like whole rights issue of sorts. We should have rights, of people to get onto online. However, we still have to deal with, the rest of the world isn't online yet. There's still portions of America's, population that don't have easy access to it. I mean, Google is doing their whole like Google Fiber thing, city at a time, I don't know what their PR face point of that, but that's just showcasing how much you can do with if you have Google Fiber in a city like Kansas City and doing that. So I feel like, it's not there yet, but I feel like our culture is still trying to come to grips with having an always on mentality. And do you feel like accessibility, making sure things that we actually produce online are just, are we improving that area and generally, like in terms of making web pages, than we were 10 years ago when we had the .com bust? Or like, do you feel like that's this, you know, like what is the nature of this,
you know,
practice of like just making sure that we'd be build accessible stuff? Cause like, I feel like this, you know, we're kind of like growing pains. I don't want to use the word growing pains, but I feel like it's like, growth spurt, I guess more than anything else.
Well, you know, I feel like it's, try to think about how to analogize this, but you know, I guess the Wild West, I mean, there's always going to be, you know, like the can I use kind of phenomenon that you just have this constant flow of new technology. And now it's kind of, you know, like infinite diversity and infinite combinations, right? You have these, all of these new technologies, all of these new JavaScript libraries, new things being added to HTML and CSS. You've got new types of hardware, you have new display sizes, new browsers for all of those things, the concept of Google Glass, mm-hmm. you know, all of this stuff is diverging madly. While at the same time, sort of HTML was kind of architected to handle that to a great extent. That it wasn't intended to be the painting canvas for, you know, for the internet. It was meant to be sort of the data structure.
Right.
Over time, like, okay, we've done a lot in all of those areas to improve the accessibility of overall mm-hmm. of, you know, HTML and, you know, and I'll say PDF too, has improved fairly dramatically over time because you have those, automated document processing systems that are pumping out like a billion, you know, PDFs a day for all of the things that used to be bills that arrived in the mail. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, so all of those things need to get better. I think that it's going to come down to moments where, you know, they've shut down the newspaper and are going strictly online. They shut down.
Well, they shut down Newsweek, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and then they're publishing using, you know, they're publishing onto the iPad, you know, that it's, those are apps, you know, so it's like, it's a software application that just happens to have some content inside of it.
Right.
And all of those things, you know, what happens is there's one group of people that goes out, the trailblazer, if you will, mm-hmm. who goes out and shows the outer range of what you can do.
Right.
And it's not easy to rein those people in. And in some cases we don't want them to be reined in by, I mean, we're talking, not just accessibility, but internationalization, security, privacy, all of these things we pretty much violate routinely when we go pretty far afield.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned like, you know, just bringing accessibility into, you know, the PDFs and so, but then you have accessibility of, like a Newsweek or a magazine that says like, oh, well, we want to take this metaphor of a magazine that's in the physical space and like put it into your iPad and go to a newsstand and buy a metaphor that represents old way of thinking. And here's your digital magazine. So that, and I don't understand. I mean, I can understand. I understand the fear of a business not wanting to shake away from that, but I don't understand. I do understand that, and I feel like there's like people like the special New York Times, was it New York Times where they did the whole snow, had a snow footer
yeah.
that was, and then The Verge did an arcade article piece that was kind of cool looking, like that was really cool. But I feel like that's like the future where they need to go, and that's like, you know, built on HTML, you know, built on CSS, and that's like way more has that. I didn't check the accessibility of it, but I feel like that's way more. That's easier to make accessible than it would be to like try to cram a layout that's supposed to be like designed in InDesign and put into a PDF and make that accessible on the fly. I mean, I'm sure maybe nobody's working on that. I have no idea. But yeah. It's a little bit outside my wheelhouse. But
actually, we kind of are. But anyway. I mean, and it's, you know, I feel like when you go out that far into into the future, there is this like moment where you kind of have to snap back and say, okay, we need to explain how this, you know, how we're going to make this better, like how this is going to work, you know, how this is going to work in the future. And a lot of the time when we, you know, like we have to have that room to expand our knowledge of how we're going to present this stuff to people. But at the same time, I feel like as we're evolving, we need to be able to ask the people, how do you expect to make this accessible? How do you expect this stuff to work right to left?
Right.
You know, how is this going to work on mobile devices? How is this going to work on wearables? You know, if this was voice only, what information would you be communicating? Not so that they instantly have an answer, because sometimes even I don't have an answer when somebody takes something like, you know, we have this this new project at Adobe where we're showing off a ruler and and a pen that you'd be able to basically draw on, you know, draw something on this device and actually sort of copy it into the, you know, into the pen and paste it onto another device. Like I really can't even fully think my way through this until I actually see it in people's hands and how they're using it, because that's the part that's important.
I give you cash money right now just to get one of those right now? Because I would totally do that right now.
Are you kidding me? I can't even. I've seen, and that's about as close as I'll get it until we have something that's at least in a, you know, in beta form. So,
okay.
Like, but I promise I will make videos of it as soon as I get a copy. I was just like, this is so cool. Ah,
Please make me jealous as soon as you can.
Yes, okay. I saw that myself, and I was like, wallet, fall out, drop 2-4, take please now.
Yeah, I was watching that. I was like, all we have to do is say, I don't know, whatever the price would be, like I'm just gonna say $19.99 or whatever. It's like, and they would have like too many orders, right? Yeah. For Adobe Keynote, Max Keynote. So I was like, oh man. But yeah. So, but what you're saying, to get back to your point, is just like, you know, they probably came to you like, you're hypothetically, I'm not sure they actually, but you know, how do I make this accessible if I copy this from one device and I go to another device and like your brain was probably like just, I don't know, just blown, probably
just jelly.
I mean, yeah.
That's the thing. Like it's, you know, if someone were to, you know, if someone were to invent, you know, a ball peen hammer, right? You know, they have like one view of how that thing would be used. But obviously there are hundreds of applications for that. You know, it's not just like, well, like a pound nails into wood. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's other stuff that you can, you know, that you can do with a ball peen hammer, and the, you know, and it evolves, like these tools evolve over time to reflect how we use them.
Yeah.
You know, and I have, you know, I have a lot of people who say like, why can't it just be accessible when we start out? And I'm like, you have to think about the, you know, this is a conversation between the producer and the consumer of that tool. You'll probably have a good grip of a couple good uses for whatever it is that you're creating. But especially as you get into things that have APIs or that have sort of different user experiences across devices, or things that are optimized for one thing or another, you know, you start to realize that whole model kind of falls apart. You have to actually look at, what are we trying to do here? What is the, you know, what are the transactions going on between the producer and the consumer, you know, or between the customer and the store, or between the citizen and the government. And that's sort of where we get a lot of the, you know, a lot of understanding of what our job is as a professional. Like, we have to have answers for that stuff. It's not necessarily that we solve that stuff immediately, but we do have to realize that there are going to be people in the United States who can legally vote who only speak Tagalog or Arabic or whatever. whether or not you've thought about it, that stuff is still going to be true. And as we get closer and closer to things like e-voting, mm-hmm. where, you know, like that, you know, that is, you know, we're getting into like human rights territory, not just kind of like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could make a nice video with a guy in a wheelchair, you know, like the kinds of, you know, drive-by accessibility sort of exploitation sometimes that we see. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like we're getting into like the serious stuff where you may actually be preventing somebody from doing something that they're, you know, that they're constitutionally protected constitutionally allowed to do.
Right. So it's like we've gone from like being passive, let's say, like in terms of displaying content, to now we're talking about the interaction, or like, you know, the whole web apps, you know, type of scenario, or beyond that in terms of like how can we make this transaction accessible, right?
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And not just for like, you know, screen readers where a person would have to buy a screen reader or install it, and then they can be it, and then they can take it in. But also, when you're actually moving things on a screen, or if you have hardware or whatever, that you,
yeah,
yeah, okay.
And it's like I kind of think about this, you know, like design is a verb, right? Like and you know, accessibility is, you know, accessibility isn't a you know, it isn't, well, okay. My Spanish teacher taught me the difference between verb tenses by saying like, this one's a boom and this one's a la-di-da. Like, I went to the store, boom. Like, I was going to the store is a la-di-da. Like, you are in a process of doing this thing. Hmm. Accessibility and design in general is a la-di-da. Like, you don't just like, I designed this and I'm done forever because there's no possible way that I could optimize it beyond this thing, because my 1.0, man, I just nailed it.
Right.
The, you know, the concept that like, oh, well, we need to, you know, like, you know, people talk about accessibility like it's this thing, like, you know, chair, desk, table accessibility. This is a concrete thing, and we just run it through this checker and we're done. Mm-hmm. It's much more than that. It's a proxy for reaching people. The same thing with internationalization. The same the same thing with privacy. There are always threats and opportunities to everything that we're doing as designers. And if we think of ourselves as, I'm a designer because I have a copy of Photoshop, and by the way, thank you, because that really does help pay my salary. We are missing out on a whole bunch of things that could make people's lives better. Mm-hmm. Not just talking about accessibility. I'm just saying we tend to think about these little narrow things and that's what makes us a designer. It's like, no, that just makes us proficient at Photoshop. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole lot more that we can that we can be thinking about with every single UX decision that we make in a given, you know, in a given site.
Right.
And that is what makes us professionals. It's the difference between being a tradesperson, mm-hmm. you know, and somebody that's actually worth the money that they're being paid. Like, right. A tradesperson has a set of techniques. They do it over and over again. Right. They don't necessarily dramatically improve the state of things over time, but mm-hmm. they get to a level of proficiency, and that's what they're good at.
Cool.
Like, a professional sees problems and starts to solve them on a broader scale, and I feel like we're at the point where we can kind of demand that of the designers that are working on the web today.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's also like nomenclature? Because I feel like you could talk to a designer and they would just be doing the GUI, right? But, you know, they'll still lay claim to a designer term as their own, which is cool, whatever. But and then you have the designer who actually thinks about the whole spiel, like, if you will, like the whole process, the whole interaction, and so that. And I feel like, you know, that is that's more in terms of like, when I think of design, I think like we have to think about the visual design, but we also have to think about the interaction. We have to think about the user experience with all the emails that we send out. How does that feel? And so, like, you know, that's the whole type of process. Do you feel like, you know, the term is, we need a new term, or the term is?
Well, is it, you know, I mean, like I kind of like the UX movement. I kind of dislike it when they think that they've got the market cornered, like that, that they're the ones that have that, that have all the answers, but they are the ones that think design's a verb. You know, that's valuable in and of itself. As long as they realize that there's a that there is a give and take, that there is a collaboration that needs to be had among a lot of different role players in in the process, that's great. But you know, you right when we started, you were talking about sort of it's weird how we all came together. You know, in 1995, like if you were a computer science person, if you were an English lit person, if you were a IT person that just somebody that was proficient with Linux, they all still called you webmaster. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was like it was a one stop shop. You were chief cook and bottle washer most of the time when they called you a webmaster. So there's always room for people to expand what it is that they do. And in larger organizations, you can have someone like a content strategist. But it is starting to feel like a user experience specialist is becoming more and more necessary as such. Mm-hmm. But I feel that they need to be the translator. They need to be the person that can, that can sit between a graphic designer and a front end engineer or, or a server side engineer and say, when the designer says, I want it to do blah.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
This is the codified version of that. Like, these are the technologies that we're kind of looking at. These are the sort of bits over the wire that you have to be concerned with. So don't just throw in like a couple hundred K of jQuery stuff for this one page. Like, right. To be able to see the whole landscape and how things can be screwed up. Like, that's just you need to have somebody that can manage that entire. I mean, like the whole experience from the time they come to the site until something arrives at their door, a manager may not understand. Like sort of old line manager, at least a lot of the ones that I've worked with, only thought about sort of the end product and not as a as a go between for all of these different warring factions of of organizations.
Right. Yeah, because the job you just explained was like the one I had in like right before the .com bust.
Yeah.
And
we're getting to the point that we all should kind of understand the state of the art across all of these disciplines. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a good artist, you know more than one medium. You know, if you can understand these schools without being like deeply, well versed in every single one of them, so that you can take these kinds of conflict and resolve them always with the idea of making this better for the person at the end of the line.
Right. Definitely. Cool. Yeah. Well, I do want to go back one step is that you weren't always the accessibility guy, because I was researching past interviews, and you're actually giving an interview when you worked with Blue Flavor.
Yep.
When was Blue Flavor?
That was, let's see, I was there from, let's see, that was,
was that before or after WebBand?
That was after Web, that was after W3C. Okay. And I don't know, I guess I kind of disagree there. I feel like if you go into the Blue Flavor blog, which may still be alive.
I don't know.
Let's take a look.
I rather just keep it in my memory. So.
Yeah. It's still there. If you look through here, blueflavor.com/blog, there's, I don't know, maybe I'm not in there anymore. I did a lot of writing in this blog for I think they're all just only Nick's posts remain. Anyway. I did a lot of writing and my sort of, superpower in Blue Flavor, which was, it was a design consultancy. There were four of us that co-founded it. And
Who are the people? Don't mind.
Brian Fling, Nick Fink, and Keith Robinson. Okay. And there were a lot of other people that came through there. Tom Watson, mm-hmm. Jeff Kraft, the Kevin Tamora, lots of really great designers that sort of came in through there.
Yeah.
But my goal in all of this was to show that if there was a high design kind of website out there, that you could do accessibility without it being a line item, like not something that somebody can scratch through.
Right.
And, you know, sort of talking about that, you know, if you present it as an option and you put a dollar figure on it,
mm-hmm.
You know, people run away, but we managed to have, you know, a series of customers that would come, that would come through. And we had like, the Washington, Department of Licensing
mm-hmm.
came to us with a specific set of requirements, to, you know, to build templates. And we, you know, we didn't say, well, if you want it to be accessible, it's going to be another 5,000, you know, I took that project on and just said, because we know how this is, you know, how this is done, the end product of it is going to be reasonably accessible. And, you know, that was sort of what I wanted to, you know, I felt like I had to prove that we could do accessibility and not have it be pitted against mm-hmm. the, you know, against making money as a consulting company.
Right. Like it wasn't an item that you, it wasn't commodity, right? It was just a way of practice. It was like best practices.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I had sort of, you know, established some kind of bona fides as an accessibility person. But the idea that if it was accessible, that it would have to be uglier or, you know, inferior in some way, I think is, you know, it's that was something that needed to be disproven. And I feel like that was my opportunity to do that.
Hmm.
So I don't ever feel like I left. I felt like I kept, you know, if you stick a poker in the fire long enough, the fire gets in the poker. Whatever I do, my goal is going to be to make sure that everybody is able, you know, to access it mm-hmm. equitably.
Yeah, it seems like that job we just talked about, where like you're the person, like you kind of laid down the technology, I guess, vision for projects and for that. So, and it's also like same goes back to the job we just mentioned before, where you had to be the person. There has to be a person that will talk to design, the front end visual designer, also talk to the back end, and be that user experience specialist, if you will, and then be able to come together for that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And my feeling about that was like the technical side of that didn't go particularly well, because I was, you know, like in my haste to come up with a solution for everything, I would always go and find like the greatest technology for one client or another. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to learn it all. So I kind of understand now the like, oh, I use Drupal or I use WordPress or use Node for Rails for everything.
And because, I will cram it down this hole no matter what.
Right. Yeah. Yes. When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But there's a lot to ramp up on when you start saying like, oh, we're going to take on a real estate client, so I'm going to learn this real estate CMS and things like that. Like that was the part that was the most exasperating about all of that stuff, is that you spent so much time learning that you didn't have that much time to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I just, cause I just came across that you were, in the interview, just, I don't want to backtrack too much, but just like, you know, you say like, I'm not an accessibility guy, but it was still there, you know, still underneath. But, you know, I also want to mention, you know, you work for Adobe.
Yes.
WCC just came out. Like, literally, I just downloaded the entire suite, like
Isn't
Monday
that
or
cool?
Tuesday.
Isn't it funny that now you can actually talk to an Adobe guy and be like, oh, I downloaded your entire suite, and they're like, cool, that's awesome.
It's like, you pirater. I think I tweeted about this, and I was kind of like, you know, you can't. I don't know. I was talking to someone about being snarky, I think last week or something like that, like on Twitter. I was like, dude, that's my wheelhouse on Twitter. I don't know what else you can do, but on Twitter. But yeah, I just like, the one benefit of having Adobe on being cloud is that I don't have to go freaking look for my DVD or of the software and have the Byzantine registration type code to type in and then pray that your servers are up and then pray that I've installed it underneath the limit of times. So yeah. I say you're like your like whole entire company, but no, just like, yeah.
I personally did all of this.
It's like, I know Matt's there wringing his hands. Like, yes, finally.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, I think like just to be able to download the whole entire thing and just like, oh man, I need some video editing software. I need to go buy, whoa, wait a second. I got this installed, you know, I got it. I'm ready to roll. But I did want to like see if, you know, what involvement, I mean, I'm not sure, this kind of backtracks into like your, what do you do day-to-day job? That's kind of a question, but like your role in terms of helping products at Adobe as well be more accessible. Like, you know, is there anything that you've put into Adobe CCS, or am I overstepping your role in Adobe Angelist, I guess?
Well, I can cover some of this. I mean, so my job as accessibility evangelist at Adobe is, you know, half internal and half external. So I go to a lot of teams and say, like, what are you doing? You know, these are the things that we need, you know, and, you know, work with them to get the, you know, to get their engineers the information that they need. Like, we have a training program. We have over 200 engineers, testers, and managers that have gone through this, you know, long, like day long accessibility training that we've developed. So that falls under evangelism. We work with them to, you know, to get the feature lists of things, you know, like watch what they're developing. Like the Edge tools are the ones that we've that I've been working most closely with lately. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, we have, so Edge Inspect, which is a you know, sort of mobile testing tool that you install a extension into Chrome, and so you can browse the sites that you're testing, and it broadcasts those same sites across all of the devices that you may have sitting around. So fantastic tool for just testing websites across Android and iOS. And but the actual interface on both sides has had accessibility tweaks so that the content will work properly. We've gotten to work with teams like that just to show the value of, if I need to do accessibility testing on iOS, Edge Inspect is a fantastic tool for doing that, because I can just throw the site from my laptop onto the device, turn VoiceOver on, and it works just like it would in Safari. I think that's a really cool way to show that, you know, even in a tool that you wouldn't necessarily think of as having an accessibility issue, mm-hmm. you can introduce that as, here's another way that you can test your site to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do. We've had meetings with like Edge Animate, that team. Last time I saw them was the PM for their project came running up to me and said, "You're the accessibility guy. Let me show you all the cool things that we're doing." You know, the first thing, and I'm not going to feel like I'm talking out of school here when I say this, like the Adobe Edge, the first preview that we released, mm-hmm. you know, we opened it up and looked at it, and it was like there was no HTML there. It was just like there was a canvas, right, and there was no content inside the canvas, and they just sort of did all of this crazy stuff using JavaScript. Well, now they have actually evolved the interface so that it is HTML. You can actually create semantics for the individual objects that you're laying out in Edge. So you can manage to some extent the reading order of the content, how it's going to read out, add alt text to images that you've inserted in there, and it works. And so it's just internally, it's an opportunity for me to reach out to, you know, to people who just need to have that, you know, that kind of extra, you know, extra point of view to say, hey, have you thought about doing this or that? Like, we have ways that make the stuff that you create more usable to a greater audience, and the content. I mean, even more importantly, we may have you know, thousands of people that are using Acrobat. Well, millions, we'll say, but we have billions of people that consume that content. So if we make, we have to think about the stuff that we're producing, knowing that there are a million ways that things could go off the rails once someone has got a copy of Acrobat. Like with Word, you know, you can create really great, accessible, semantically correct, well-designed things by setting the styles and then using the headings and the lists and all of the things that the Word interface gives you. But if you just got hired into a company and it's your first time using Word, what you're going to do is you're going to highlight the text and you're going to make it big and you're going to change the color and you're going to bold it and then you're going to think that that's a heading. And that's just poor user education. But unless you correct that, that's just how things are going to go. Yeah. And there are some things that as a software developer, you can prevent errors from happening before they, you know, before people break it. Mm-hmm. But there's always a better way to break it, right? So we, you know, so those are the kinds of things that we as an authoring tool provider express to, you know, to our product teams to say, like, you have an opportunity every time this page gets created to do a good job. Mm-hmm. We have that capability and to the greatest extent possible, we want to make sure that we do that. So those are the kinds of messages that I tell our own people. And then of course there's, you know, giving talks in the public about what we do. And, you know, I give a lot of talks. Actually, you think you've been in the audience for one of my talks on universal design. So it's really, I have a lot of different ways to, you know, to reach out to people and, you know, the word evangelist actually comes from, you know, it's a biblical term, but it's like I think it's Greek, I think, for like spreader of good news. Mm. You know, we have a lot of good news to talk about, and you know, and for a lot of people that have some experience with accessibility, they feel like it's all bad news. Like, we're going to hold them back, and we're like, no. We actually have some great techniques now that can let you do the things that you want to do the way that you want them to appear, mm-hmm. in the processes in which you create them. Mm-hmm. And all you do is add like an aria attribute here or there, or right. you know, or you'd be able to set alt text for a given thing. All of that stuff is, you know, it's good. We're making things better, you know, one step at a time.
Yeah, well, I will say, like as you said, you know, part of your job as an evangelist and being out there and speaking, and even speaking at the online summit, the Accessibility Summit. I don't know for how many years now, but I think the first time, I think the second year maybe, you did a talk that I was not expecting it at all. And I probably should have, but it was so inspiring that I was like, I'm hearing an inspiring talk from Matt May, which is about accessibility, which I didn't think I would get. And it was so awesome that, you know, it's like we're getting him back again and again. And it's just like, because you know, it goes back to the whole good news part of it. And so it's just really just. It just makes you want to go out and say, yeah, we're going to do this. This is the right way we've been doing it. And you know, and to kind of bring it back to, like, I'm a big promoter of accessibility and trying to get into our websites. And as a book author, you know, I can't go to my publishers and say, I want to write a book about accessibility, because they're like, well, no one wants to buy it, you know. Yeah. But so now I just say, I want to write a book about images for the web. I'm just going to bake accessibility into it.
Exactly.
You know, and I'm just I'm not gonna hide that. I'm not gonna do it. It's gonna be there. You can't take it out. So it's just
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations, you're grown-ups now. Yeah. That's yeah. And that's, I mean, that's a lot of what we do. And you know, I feel like the Accessibility Summit is, I mean, like, those are my people, right? Yeah. I I give the same talk. I've given the same talk to Accessibility Summit that I've given to South by Southwest. Mm. And I know that that talk resonates in different ways to different, to different audiences.
Mm. Well, how'd it go down in South by?
I think it went pretty well. I mean, the issue is like there are 20,000 people at South by and I had like 100, and it's kind of, any kind of advocacy that actually tries to get people off their asses is, it's always rough on the speaker. Cause like you kind of cap your speaker score at 4, like, and you should do something too. Yeah. Wait, what? No, I'm just here cause lunch is next. Yeah. So, it's one of those things where like that if you, I tried to create a message that, that resonates with people and sort of gets people to think about the next step of like, just if I can get somebody who's like a neutral, who's neutral on accessibility in general to stop and think about it the next time they're doing something new and crazy, I feel like I've done my job. To the extent that I can get people to actively advocate for the things that I'm talking about, so much better. But the, I try not to be, exploitative. I've seen a lot of people who talk about accessibility in a way that indicates that they don't really work that closely with people with disabilities, because it's like, oh, look at how how inspirational they are. They like that. A lot of people rail against that because they're just like, I'm not trying to be inspirational. I'm just trying to get on with my day. Like, there's just some stuff that I have to deal with that you don't, but it doesn't make me a hero or, they're not asking for help. They're not asking to be treated specially. It's just, they just want to have the same kind of day everybody else is having. Right. And so, I want to just talk about people like they're people, mm-hmm. and realize that that we're all on our own different grind, right? We all have stuff that we're, have stuff that we're dealing with. But to the extent that we can all work together, to the extent that we can be inclusive, without pandering or stereotyping or, those are the things that make us all feel like we're all in this together. So those are the kinds of messages that I tried to impart. Everybody's a producer and a consumer. We're all trying to live our lives and be happy. And, there's so much benefit to be gained by actually thinking about the other person, to thinking about what we could do to make a more inclusive world in general. This is just one aspect of it, but it does open your mind up to a lot of other things that we could be doing, societally. So that's why I'm an evangelist, I guess.
I think it's a good, very good reason. So, I think it's a good way to end the show. On that note, I can't think of a better one, but, how can people find you on the internet? And also your book is, Universal Design for Web Application. Even though it's kind of old, I still feel like I haven't picked it up in a while, but like when I read it, not too long ago, like I looked at it again not too long ago, I still felt it was kind of still, I felt like it gave you like the right mindset to approach things. Yeah. Or is it too old, like too tied to technology for people to pick up now, you think? Or
I feel like it's a 50-50. There's half of the book is about technology that, this came out like with the iPhone 3G, I think. Mm-hmm. So it was in 2008. Mm-hmm. And it was, so we were in the era where there were JavaScript libraries that were being, that were built so that you could make web pages that emulated iPhone apps and stuff like that. But that's like old hat. That's done we're off into like the phone gap and what are the other ones for like HTML to iPhone or cross platform kinds of applications. So we're getting to the to this period where we were kind of hacking our way through in the technology, and now I keep, you know, sort of building up material so that we could do a second edition of this. That's kind of like, now we are where we needed to be, but it's slow going. I will say that, though, that the advocacy part is the other half of the book, and I just read through it a few months ago, and that part I think is still very relevant to just the process of, you know, just getting through to organizations why this is important, what we can, you know, what we can do and how we can do it in a way that doesn't, you know, blow a budget or take a ridiculous extra amount of time, which all basically boils down to, if you know about the stuff beforehand, you're going to, you know, you're not going to be digging yourself any holes as you go through the process. So yeah, so universal design for applications. Hopefully someday in the future, I will be able to talk more about doing a second edition and getting that out there. I'm a little oversubscribed at the moment, so we're thinking and talking about it. So there's hope on that end.
Okay, cool. And then how can people find you on Twitter or anywhere else?
I'm
blog or whatnot.
Yeah, I'm Matt May pretty much everywhere. I'm not really blogging much, but if you look, I'm Matt May on Twitter. The Adobe Accessibility blog is blogs.adobe.com/accessibility.
Oh, cool.
I'm on the Facebooks and the LinkedIns and all that fun stuff too. So I'm not hard to find. If you Google me, I'm the first one up, I think. So
cool. Awesome. There you go. Cool. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and talk to you later.
All right. Bye.